Welcome to the Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. Today we're going to be talking to Peter McFarlane about his new book, which is, I hope is available everywhere, will be. If it's not in your library, if it's not in your bookstore, ask him for a copy. It's published by Baraka Books, and the title is The Last Call for Canada, Sovereign Nation or Vassal State. And in the latter part of the show, we're going to be playing some songs of the great folk group, The Travelers, featuring my wife, Simone Taylor, who has sadly passed away this past week. And we're dedicating the show, of course, to her memory and to her inspiration. And it seemed to be necessary, important, to be talking about these subjects of the fate of Canada, matters of war and peace, because that was what the Travelers addressed in their music. And there's always history to be told about how great musical groups that address the world's issues come into being. So we'll be talking about that in the second half. I believe we're joined by Peter McFarlane. Are you there, Peter?
Yes, I am.
Peter, it's so good to talk to you. Your book, you must have written this with gritted teeth. It's called Last Call for Canada, Sovereign Nation or Vassal State. And from reading it, and particularly your introduction and or preface, this is actually Canada's existential issue practically from the beginning, is it not?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it really is. And I think it starts out with that one fact that Canadians don't often consider, that, but for most of our history, we've kind of been the junior partner of the dominant imperial power, first the British, then the Americans. And I think this leaves us very exposed now, because the type of actions that are needed to be done in the world are fairly bold. And we're used to falling into line. And I think the quote, even that Carney used, of going along to get along. And that's been our policy in the past. And it's not going to serve us very well going into the future.
Isn't that a sad expression to hear from a prime minister of a country, that going along to get along? And you bring it into the early part of this book, you touch on this peculiar, we have this phenomenon of our leaders. Probably, it seems to me, Mackenzie King must have embodied it, this whole thing of always equivocation. Conscription if necessary, but not necessarily conscription. And in the case of recent leaders, the one who showed the most shoulders, if not elbows, was Pierre Trudeau. But inevitably, there's a kind of, it's almost like a force drawing Canada back always into this imperial network. And I mean the Western network, where despite declarations and changes of flag, you have to fall in line. And that's where we are now. You described, I thought it was wonderful, your description of the Justin Trudeau's trips to the White House and Carney's. And in the case of Justin, he used a term which was, I'd forgotten you, and people should read this book to see Last Call for Canada. Justin Trudeau was asked what would happen You could tell that story where Trump put the question to him.
That was really essential. It was kind of a part of the inspiration to the book because I found it so surprising. It was when Justin Trudeau turned up in Mar-a-Lago unannounced.
The real White House.
Yeah, the real White House to meet with Trump. And this was in December 2024. This was before the inauguration. And Trump had already been suggesting the 51st state idea. So Trudeau got down there for a dinner. And during the dinner, Trump asked him, what would happen if we put a 25% tariff on Canadian automobiles coming to the United States? And Trudeau answered, that would be the end of Canada. And that really struck me as incredible. It's a country that's been around for, at that point, 158 years. And this is the prime minister, and he's saying a 25% tariff would be the end of Canada. And it just showed you how tied into the American, psychologically, not only economically, the Canadian elite are. Not necessarily the people, we see that later, the people and the elite, there's a bit of a division here. But that really struck me. And I think what I did in the book, too, was go back and look at where did we come first into the American orbit and how did we get in there so strongly? And you go back to the Beaumont missile election in 1963, and a book written inspired by it by George Grant was A Lament for the Nation, and that was the time that Canada kind of switched allegiances from the British to the American, and it was a very important moment in Canadian history, brilliantly told it by George Grant, where we started that continentalist slide. I think you mentioned Pierre Trudeau, and I think Pierre Trudeau was a reaction against that embrace of the Americans. And he went to he traveled to China, he traveled to Russia, he traveled to Cuba, he traveled to Europe. And
Cuba thing was quite dramatic when you think of it.
Yeah,
that is one moment when we were completely out of step.
That's right. And to Russia, it was a time during the Vietnam War, and there was a major a loss of thousands of troops, American troops, and so it was quite a scandal for him to turn up in Russia trying to broker peace. But that was kind of a reaction to the slide into the American. But it was overturned very decisively with the Mulroney election and the free trade, and that was the continentalization of the country really began in earnest then with the free trade agreement, of course, with the Americans. And since then, we've been on that track. I think in 2019, there was the Canadian-U.S.-Mexico agreement, the trade agreement, where Canada had even surrendered its right to have a free trade agreement with China. Excuse me. In it. So Canada has been going down that path in an accelerated way, I think. Mm-hmm. Even in the 2000s, we started fighting American wars in Afghanistan and Libya. We never did that before. By 2010, 2015, Canada was being refused its bid for a seat on the Security Council because we were seen as another American proxy.
Is this a result of this declaration by Bush Sr. that now the Soviets have gone and there is going to be a new world order? And so Canada's old role as a kind of quasi-mediator between the blocs, in a sense, from that to having to line up, wear the uniform, and go serve the empire.
Absolutely, because after the fall of course, the Soviet Union, it was a unipolar world, no question. It was an American-run world. They set the priorities. It was the American dominance in economically, militarily, and of course the Europeans and the West always claimed kind of the moral superiority. So it was that unipolar dominance, and of course during that period, Canada was becoming more and more part of the American empire. And I think in 2015, the great Egyptian economist Samir Amin, he was no longer even listing Canada as an independent country. He saw us as an external province of America. So the world has been noticing this, but Canadians have not been really noticing how deep we are into the American empire and how the pace is actually accelerating, not getting slower.
This matter of the word vassal, it strikes me as... It's almost verboten, right? We're not supposed to say it. I recall an incident, and you write about it in the book, and it seems to me we really ought to soberly look at what happened. But the it was Trump who called on, I guess it was Justin Trudeau, to say, and he said through his number two or three guy, we want you to apprehend the leader of a Huawei, executive officer of the Huawei company, and hold her, and then we want you to transfer, we want to transfer her to the United States. And that night, or the night after, on CBC, I was watching a number of commentators, and one of them said, are we a vassal state? Why would we do that? He says there's no crime, nothing alleged against the company or her in Canada, and Trump is who he is. Why would we, are we a vassal? And you know, I never heard the word vassal again on the CBC after that.
Yeah, no, that was really a good indication of where we were, because the two other countries, I think it was Mexico and Belgium, had refused to arrest her, because she had not only not committed a crime, let's say, in Canada, she had not committed any act that was considered a crime in Canada. This was a very technical U.S., well, it was
New Jersey court or something.
Yeah. And it was, what they charged her with was not even a crime in Canada, which she had done. It was something about filing papers or something like that. And so it was clearly a, it became very clear, because a week after we arrested her, kidnapped her, whatever she wanted to call it, Trump said he would free her depending on the relations with China, the trade relations. So basically she was a hostage. And we took her hostage, and we kept her for a couple of years. And of course China responded by kidnapping or holding two Michaels, although as spies. Although the one Michael at the end ended up suing the other Michael because he was working for the Canadian government, and the Canadian government paid $7 million to one of the Michaels who was taken advantage of.
Meanwhile, the whole country went through a melodrama about the Michaels.
Right.
And we're practically on a war footing of nonsense.
Yeah.
Where nobody, by the way, no journalist said, well, can we look at their record closely? I mean, who are these guys?
Yeah.
Is it possible one of them is improperly conducting himself? We always talk here about, oh, the Russians are spying, the Chinese are spying, the Cubans, I don't know, Iranians. But the country, no one ever says, do we spy on them?
Right, yeah.
And the answer is yes.
Yeah, the whole incident was really telling, because if we back up a bit, Justin Trudeau, when he got elected, he was going to make good relations with China and good relations with Russia and Iran, actually. That was part of his after Harper. And he was negotiating a free trade agreement with China in December 2016. And then Trump got into power and made China an enemy, and Canada pulled right out. They never had anything to do and never visited the Chinese leaders again until Carney did, 9 years later. So this is a sign that when the Americans really define our foreign policy, and we've just fallen behind.
Yeah. We're speaking to Peter McFarlane, author of Last Call for Canada, Sovereign Nation or Vassal State. And Peter, you have devoted a chapter to the dragon. Maybe we ought to call it the friendly dragon. This, you know, this conception that that they sell us, no one, you do it. I mean, you address the fact. This is not a country that's looking for trouble with Canada. If we could just throw all the everybody else get aside, there's no problem at all.
Exactly. Yeah.
Why do we have an adversarial approach? And I think they use the dirty word democracy. Could you address those two things?
Yeah. Well, I was China is obviously in very advanced technologically. You know, I was in China a couple of weeks ago, and a train from Shanghai to Beijing travels at 350 kilometers an hour. The country's infrastructure is impeccable. Population is very well educated, and has done an amazing job on eradicating poverty. There's virtually no homelessness, for example. So that's inside China. But for me, the importance of China is that it's anchoring kind of a new hope for international development, you know, that's reflected in the BRICS. And our propaganda, as you mentioned, democracy, it likes to portray the rivalry with the BRICS as democracies against the authoritarians. But when you look at BRICS, which I'm founding, three of the five founding countries, it includes the biggest democracy in South America, Brazil, the biggest democracy in Africa, South Africa, and the biggest democracy in the world, India. So BRICS is really just an alternative route to get away from Western dominance. It includes all sorts of countries. Now I think it's like 15 or 16 with the BRICS Plus. And they're trying to just escape Western dominance that they've been, you know, underneath the thumb of the West for a couple hundred years. So it's a time when we have to find new ways of building economies. And BRICS offers countries a possibility of exploring their own route. They don't have to fall under the sort of the heel of the Western dominance.
Our problem is the punitive power of the United States by the way, we're not the only vassals.
That's right.
The British, the French, to a large extent, the Germans. We all are watching the Germans. The New York Times had a headline the other day: "The Germany is rearming." That's encouraging. But if they any gesture, any attempt to develop a trade relation which would stabilize us and actually open us to the technological advances, economic opportunities. There's a big hammer in Washington, and it's getting more and more blatant. By the way, is that a sign that they're in trouble, or what do you think make of that?
Oh, absolutely, they're in trouble. I mean, that's how Trump is kind of like a demonic character, but he's also, it's not random, you know. They've lost their dominance economically and in the other areas as well, and he's out there trying to grab what he can for the empire as, you know, from friends and enemies, taking what he can. And you know, whatever he takes will be kept by whoever follows him. This is a major American move. It's not just a Trump move, what he's doing in the world, losing the world. So, yeah, I think... that's where we're heading now, and we have to deal with that. And I think we can only deal with that by freeing ourselves from this kind of vassal state, which is, as you mentioned, it's increasingly covering the countries of Europe as well.
Mm-hmm. Eddie, you also raise, and I'll keep reminding people, it's the last call for Canada, but Peter McFarlane and Baraka Books. There is a tendency to look across the border and say, well, we have friends, the liberals. But that isn't so.
No.
You point out that all kinds of things were done by Trump in his first time out, early 2016, I guess it was, through 20. And he did outrageous things. He moved the embassy to Jerusalem, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. He tore up the agreement with the Islamic Republic, which would have prevented all this violence that's going on now. And the notion is, well, maybe the Biden Obama types will save us, but they what do they do when they come back into office?
Yeah, that's right. They kept all his policies in place. And also the tariffs on China that they were ridiculed. They ridiculed Trump in the first in 2016 for that. They said that tariffs never work, but they kept those tariffs on China. And yes. And they, as you say, they kept the embassy in Jerusalem, and they never picked up the agreement with Iran again. They left to the whole situation to fester, and that's what we have had today with the war.
Yeah. The 100% tariff on the autos was Biden and Canada.
Yeah,
100%. Now we want to make nice.
That's it. Yeah, the deal we made finally was very small. It was a 3% deal, but I mean, it was an important symbol. But Carney, he seems to specialize in important symbols, but he gives away the store. His philosophy really seems to be speak softly and carry a little stick when he deals with the Americans. He gets nothing in return other than a little bit of verbiage.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about this. What is over the horizon? And you raise the specter And by the way, this is a very sobering book. It must have been difficult to write it, actually, because you are challenging the kind of illusions that are being posted up. And particularly, you take up the Davos speech. And that seems to be really important, not because it was true and going to inspire, but because it revealed all kinds of problems. Can you talk about what was in that speech and where would the difficulties lie?
Yeah, I think that the speech was kind of an amazing piece of theater, you know, and he was praised, I think, legitimately so, when he admitted that the whole rules-based order was basically a fraud of the West on the rest of the world. And part of the fraud was so they could avoid actual international law. So he was praised for saying that, and I think he deserved it. But the second part of the speech, it was his solution. But his solution, I was looking at what leading economists were saying about it from the left and the right, mm-hmm. and they called it, you know, silly Davos talk and that sort of thing. Because what he was suggesting was that the middle powers could get together and somehow reform the world in their image. But you know, almost every major political scientist and economist said that's not how it works in the world. It's the big big powers that dominate, they always will, and they always have. And so I think they described Charney's ideas as Atlanticism with Canadian characteristics, and it's not something that's going to work.
By the way, that's a great title for a chapter, that the Carney Gambit, Atlanticism with Canadian characteristics.
Yeah, that's it.
That chapter alone, should every Canadian should read that. Please go on. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. And so, and I think Carney and the Europeans, they don't seem to realize that the West itself has kind of crossed a point of no return. You can't go back to what it was, even to 10, 20 years ago, with the rise of China and the other power points in the world. So it's lost its economic dominance, its military dominance, as we see in Iran, and its moral authority as well. You know, with Gaza, you know, I think I quote in the book Arundhati Roy, the great Indian writer, and she said something to the effect that the charade of Western liberal democracy is buried under the rubble in Gaza, along with tens of thousands of Palestinians. And I think that's very, very true of where we are now, and trying to rebuild a post-world order as it was 10, 20 years ago, even, it's going to fail. It's that we have to turn the page on that. It is a different world. It's a multipolar world. And if Canadians don't realize that and adjust themselves kind of dramatically, their orientation to taking into account that America's to the south, China's to the west, Russia to the north, and Europe is to the east, And deal with all those countries and have good relations with all those countries and try to take advantage of their position with all those countries, it's going to sink down with the rest of the West.
Actually, you make it very clear that it's entirely up to the will of the Canadian people, because they actually have voted with their feet in terms of traveling, and they also have, every poll shows that they expect the prime minister, actually they would prefer that he come home or not go to Washington if he's going to be referred to as a governor.
Right.
I mean, why isn't there a resolution in our parliament saying we're not to have relations with any government that refers to our prime minister as a governor?
Yeah, that was, I forget, the former Liberal cabinet minister made that point right away. Why hasn't Canada had a resolution saying, no, we will not ever be the 51st state, and we're, you know, condemning some of the statements of the American administration about Canada.
It's called diplomacy. I mean, you just say it. You're not going to war. You're just saying, no, we don't do that.
Yeah, no, but we never had a resolution to that effect, and that's a very good point that you're making, and it's another really good example of where we are in the world. And I say where again. It's more our elites than the people. The people have been surprisingly combative on this point, but the elites have been kind of talking out of both sides of the mouth and surrendering our sovereignty piece by piece as it goes on.
Yeah, actually, you featured the opening chapter is about the elbows and the visit that of first we had the one by of Trudeau where he said we would collapse, and then we had the one by Carney, which was considered a big improvement, although you point out it had such sad qualities built into it. Where he's kind of raising his hand, can I say something? And then Trump goes on. And
that's right, yeah.
And then, he always goes into this thing, well, you're a great economy, and of course we, but at the same, but he's ending up in the hands of following I guess we could call it Cold War language. We can't seem to break out of Cold War language.
Right, exactly, yeah.
You're the leader. We got to face face them. Who's them?
Yeah,
I want to ask you about that. About the he used the term middle power, and within a week, I think it was, it may have even been before, he was indicating his love for middle powers. One of them was called Finland, and the other is Latvia. If we're unhappy and worried about Trump, why are our soldiers on the front line in Latvia?
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's it. And it was during that early 2005 when he was making the speech, or 2006 when he was making the speech, that at Davos, Canada had Carney personally had issued a press release celebrating the U.S. Kidnapping of Maduro and the attack on Venezuela. He did the same thing initially with the beginning of the Iran war, Iran-Israel. Mm-hmm. He backed the Americans, and on Cuba, He refused to criticize the Americans who are still in process of strangling Cuba. And I think in the book, I compare it to Mexico that does value sovereignty. It's an absolute for the Mexicans, not only their own sovereignty, but the rights of every country to be independent. And they, of course, they criticize with great intensity the American actions in Venezuela and Cuba and Iran. And they're sending goods to shiploads and shiploads to Cuba to help them survive. Mm-hmm. But Canada does not really believe in sovereignty. It believes in conditional sovereignty, and it believes that the dominant power has the right to decide how much sovereignty each country has. And we see that time and again when Canada supports these kind of actions by the Americans that deny the sovereignty of other countries.
Yes, and we have imperialist hubris.
Yeah.
We have to always judge everybody. Someone says, well, should we have trade with China? And three or four people leap up in Parliament and say, well, let's talk about the Uyghurs.
You
say,
that's right.
Well, why don't we talk about indigenous people in Canada?
Exactly.
We have some unresolved questions here. And by the way, you're one of the people pointing out. Peter McFarland has a wonderful Twitter site. I urge people to read it. But, I mean, this thing of saying, well, now we have to change our footing. Now we really have to get serious. We have to build our military, and we have to hurry with the pipelines, et cetera. And you point out in your accounts, this is becomes an excuse to override the Indigenous Canadians, but also by creating a kind of a crisis, the idea of, well, we have to build up our defense and all that, it means that a whole bunch of questions, domestic questions, employment, quality of life, et cetera, go by the boards while those who are really working on the crisis push us around.
Yeah, absolutely. And I contrast it to Mexico again with Mexico that has good relations with all the countries China, Russia, and Europe. It's not part of any blocs, and it holds to non-interference in every country's affairs. And Mexico has no real enemies that we do because we're part of NATO and the Western Bloc, which is out there creating enemies all the time. Yes. And so even the Claudia Sheinbaum, the president, she even invited Putin to her inauguration. They just are not going to get in that game, and they are they spend 1% of their budget on the military, and we now are spending 5% of our not the budget of the GDP. So we're going down with the West.
Yes.
And in a very serious way.
Well, you're living, you have touched on so many important questions. And, you discuss an impossible, I guess, I can use the word analogy, but what happened with Puerto Rico And right. I would assume, actually, that in the minds of the U.S., they don't really want Canada to be a state. What they'd like it to be is a kind of a protectorate, something along the lines of Puerto Rico. But we have a Puerto Rico, and I wanted to ask you, how are we going to break this business to Quebec? Because they are a nation, according to our parliament. And
right.
they actually have a different culture.
Right.
They actually have a different language. And Americans only speak one language. And as a matter of fact, I mean, they expect the whole world to speak American English, not even English, but
that's
American.
Right.
And I guess to have cage fighting in every city to show that you're really with it. But isn't it, I mean, that's... Quebec actually is not digestible. They're like Puerto Rico. They, by the way, identify. Quebec has always had an identification with Puerto Rico. They are aware of each other.
That's it. And I think the solution would be a Puerto Rico-style solution for the Americans to take over or control Canada. I mean, Puerto Rico has its own government. They don't vote when you're living in Puerto Rico. You don't vote for the American president. You don't vote for anybody for Congress. You can only vote for your own government. So it's a self-governing place, but it's under the control of the State Department, the American government, and they control their foreign policy. They have no foreign policy. We have very little foreign policy outside of the American.
Yes.
And so we're not that far away. I mean, if we adopted the dollar, the American dollar, that's pretty well it. We're pretty well then Puerto Rico when you look at their economic and other control that they have. You know, it's a self-governing external province is what Samir Amin called us, and that's pretty close where we are now.
Yeah, no, these are real dilemmas. You have cited, I guess, if you want people to really understand, you're urging that they return to the work of Professor Grant, The Lament for a Nation.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a
are
short
you nuts?
Book. Yeah, it's a short book. Everybody should read it. It tells you so much about Canada today. It's uncanny. Some of the chapters there you will read and you think that he was writing in 2026 about Canada, about the Canadian elite and about our relations with the American, about our business relations with the Americans. It's all there. And there's that. And there's also the work of Professor Irvin Studen. You might look him up because he's been working for 10 years to try to get Canada to adopt policy that takes into account the multipolar world, and he's quite a brilliant guy too. So those two would be very worthwhile, I think, for people to consult.
Yeah. Well, I think the place to start is Last Call for Canada's Sovereign Nation or Vassal State, and it's written by Peter McFarlane, and it's really a very nicely written, tightly argued case. I'd say it's a sobering up moment for Canada. And Peter, you've done a great job. We really appreciate you giving us the time today.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Phil.
Thank you.
Yep. Have a good day. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. And we're going to play some music by the Travelers. And I would say from their heyday when they were at the Expo 67.